It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Another deadly bombing hits northeast Nigeria. Hundreds of thousands of African refugees face food funding cuts. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. A massive car bomb explosion in northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri Tuesday killed as many as 56 people. The blast at a popular market came from explosives hidden under charcoal in the back of a pickup truck or van. There's been no claim of responsibility, but officials have focused their blame on the Islamist group Boko Haram. Meanwhile, the country's finance minister warned Tuesday the insurgency by Boko Haram will slow economic growth, knocking up to one half of one percentage point of growth as it did last year. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala told Reuters he expects 6.75% growth in Nigeria this year. The number of deaths from West Africa's Ebola outbreak continues to rise as officials scramble to contain the situation. The World Health Organization says nearly 470 have now died from Ebola since March. The WHO confirmed or suspects 759 cases in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, where President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has declared a public emergency. Dr. Mohamed Vandi is the Kenema Governmental Hospital District Medical Officer in eastern Sierra Leone.
They are free. Those who are able to run away have run away. Those who are not, like the maternity ward, people are still there. You go to the surgical ward, people are still there. But the main ward, I think, as you rightly said, they have gone because they think if they stay here, they will be infected with Ebola. That's why they have gone. I believe we can contain this here in Kenema. And if we do that, we can save the rest of the country from getting the infection. We can control it here. And that's why we are even mounted another checkpoint outside Kenema, just outside Kenema. That's the only road leading to the rest of the country.
Health ministers from 11 African countries hold a two-day meeting in Ghana today on efforts to control the outbreak. The United Nations Tuesday said African refugees fleeing war and persecution face cuts in their daily rations because of a $225 million shortfall for vital food programs. Some 800,000 refugees are setting to begin getting less food than they need because of low funding, insecurity, and logistical problems. UN emergency directors on Tuesday called for more funding for southern Somalia. One project there is helping local farmers develop more sustainable agricultural methods. David Kotrud is with the World Food Program.
Part of the reason why I'm here with my counterparts from UNICEF and FAO, who believe so strongly in this approach, will be to make advocacy, demonstrating that this, which is essentially a pilot, an initial effort, needs to be taken at scale in a vulnerable country like Somalia to break cycles of vulnerability and build resilience. And so we will be part of that resource mobilization effort. However, we're realistic. It is a tough time in the world with Syria, Iraq, CAR, South Sudan. It is a tough time to raise resources. But we can make a very compelling case from what we've seen today.
Drought, conflict, and a lack of food aid has left over 3 million people in southern Somalia at risk of starvation since 2011. At UN headquarters Tuesday, the world body documented more than 4,000 cases of children recruited and used in fighting in 2013, with thousands believed to have joined armies and rebel groups worldwide. Zeyla Zarugi is the UN Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict.
As you know, the government of South Sudan have signed an action plan to end the recruitment and use of children by the SPLA, the South Sudanese army, in 2012. The gain, unfortunately, made by the government to address grave violations against children have been reversed since the last crisis started. Boko Haram has increased attacks on schools, killing and maiming dozens of children, as well as other grave violations. As you all know, this continues, unfortunately, in 2014.
She says Chad has been removed from the so-called list of shame because its national army has implemented all measures to protect children in an action plan signed in conjunction with the world body. Libyan rebels blockading key eastern oil ports have agreed to reopen the remaining two terminals they control at Es-Sider and Ras Lanuf today as a goodwill gesture. It's a move that could restore Libya's lost exports. The rebels, seeking autonomy, agreed in April to reopen two other smaller ports, all four seized nearly a year ago, crippling the country's oil industry. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
the Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is said to be getting worse.
The main problem now is that there is insufficient staff who is able to implement communication activities to tackle this kind of a problem.
Dr. Guido Borghese is UNICEF's child advisor for child survival and development in Western Central Africa. Gender-based violence against Central African Republic refugees in Eastern Cameroon is on the rise. We'll examine the impact of terrorism on Kenya's East Coast economy. And the United Nations says the rights of children in conflict zones are being violated.
I saw myself, children with guns, with the government, but also with armed groups, with David Yaw, with the SSLA, and with the opposition under Riek Machar.
Leila Zurugi is the UN envoy on children and armed conflict. Swaziland's banned opposition hopes the cancellation of the country's AGOA eligibility will speed up multi-party democracy, and the bone marrow transplant is successful in treating sickle cell disease. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization says the number of deaths from West Africa's Ebola outbreak continues to rise. This comes as an emergency meeting of West African health ministers is underway today, Wednesday, in Accra to address the growing Ebola outbreak. Dr. Guido Borghese, UNICEF's chief advisor for child survival and development in West and Central Africa, tells Ricky Shryak that the gathering in Accra needs to address national staff shortages in the entire West Africa sub-region if officials there hope to stem the spread of the deadly fever.
What I'm expecting from the Accra meeting is that, first of all, we will have a momentum to have all partners together, national and international, to discuss and to see for the first time this issue, not as a Liberia or Sierra Leone or Guinea, but as a regional issue.
What is the current situation? The numbers in Sierra Leone are jumping every day right now, it appears. So is this worrying that it's still growing?
The number of new cases, is increasing every day. But the situation of much concern, if you wish, is not really alarming, but is a great concern for the region. The main reason is that is now to be considered as a regional epidemic because of permeability of the borders in this region and the movement of a population, and also because there is still a misperception of the disease and with fear from population, rumors, and this affects also the performance of response.
Yes, you mentioned the fears of the disease, and I've heard about certain cases where people flee the hospitals, or if they have Ebola, they go into hiding because they don't want to go to the hospital. Do you hope that at this ministerial meeting coming up in Accra on July 2nd, people will talk about what they can do to stop this? Because I'm guessing this is one of the biggest factors in the continuing spread of the disease.
The main problem now is that there is insufficient staff who is able to implement communication activities to tackle this kind of a problem. Not only communication activities, but also the tracking of the contacts. Because so far the response was provided by international NGOs, but now we are in a situation where we have to scale up the response, and this requires availability of more staff and with adequate competencies. I hope that the solution to the problem that we just mentioned will be identified, and the problem will be analyzed, and a plan on how to mobilize human and financial resources will have this plan at the end of this meeting.
That was Dr. Guido Borghese, UNICEF Chief Advisor for Child Survival and Development in Western Central Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. The United Nations says gender-based violence against Central African Republic refugees in East Cameroon is very high. It has called on the government in Yaoundé to do more to protect vulnerable women. Moki Edwin Kinzeka traveled to Eastern Cameroon and filed this report.
Thousands of people from the Central African Republic, CAR, continue to stream into Cameroon, the country in the region where most have gone to escape violence during the last 6 months. Most of the 11,000 refugees here in this border village of Gado are women and girls. But instead of finding safety, many face new threats, including rape. One victim, 17-year-old Duma Divina, says she and her family were assaulted repeatedly. She says she, her mother and her five sisters were abused for 2 weeks by armed men while escaping violence in the CAR. United Nations officials say that even in the refugee camps, these women still face attacks from men both inside and outside the camps. Nurse Defonta Amabel says cattle ranchers also abuse the women.
Since the place is a cattle rearing zone, they meet people who take care of cattle and they sexually assault them. Many of them come in a very devastating situation and some of them come here while pregnant.
Dr. Kepe Jacques of the non-governmental organization Doctors Without Borders told VOA that lots of the victims are suffering from sexually transmissible infections, including AIDS.
We find sometimes even situations as bad as vaginal lacerations, where you actually see that, you know, there are some tears around the vagina, bruises to show that this was really a forceful sex, and maybe not just by one person. Sometimes the women do confess that they were done by multiple persons on the same woman.
The UN representative for women in Cameroon, Rachel Mian Jagone, tells VOA her group is working to educate women on their rights with respect to gender-based violence.
Les actions proposées par UNIFEM sont des actions qui sont très pertinentes, notamment les.
She says education for women is crucial since so many refugee women are suffering trauma in silence. She says they are setting up units to care for survivors of rape and other violence and are also recruiting social workers to teach women both their rights and how to invest in little businesses so they can have some sort of financial autonomy. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Gado.
The United Nations says thousands of children are being recruited and used as combatants, killed, wounded, and sexually abused in 23 conflict areas across the world by governments, terrorists, and armed groups. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
In a new report Tuesday, UN Envoy on Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi, said her office has documented cases of children recruited and used as soldiers by 8 national armies and 51 armed groups in the past year. She also highlighted grave rights violations against children, including death, maiming, sexual violence, and attacks on schools and hospitals. Some of the most serious situations are reported in Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, and South Sudan. In Syria, where a civil war is raging into its fourth year, the UN estimates that more than 10,000 children have been killed. Zarugi said her office has documented widespread and grave violations against children there.
The conflict and violence in Syria reached unprecedented levels during 2013. No sign of improvement since the beginning of the year, and no political solution in sight.
In her report, Zarugi said armed groups, including several associated with the opposition Free Syrian Army, as well as Islamist groups ISIL and Jabhat al-Nusra, are recruiting and using children for logistics, handling ammunition, manning checkpoints, and as combatants. Armed groups also continue to kill and injure children, rape girls, and target schools. In neighboring Iraq, where ISIL fighters recently have made bold military gains, Zarugi said it is creating extremely violent and dangerous conditions for children. Her report says nearly 8,000 civilians were killed last year, and at least 250 of them were children. Terror groups in Africa also are responsible for attacks on children, most notably in Nigeria. Boko Haram, which has kidnapped scores of schoolgirls in the country's north, has repeatedly targeted schools. According to the UN report, the group also has children as young as 12 in its ranks. In South Sudan, Zarugi said gains in reintegrating child soldiers back into society have been reversed by the political conflict that erupted in mid-December. She recently visited the country.
I saw myself, children with guns, with the government, but also with armed groups, with David Yawiyaw, with the SSLA, and with the opposition under Riek Machar.
On a positive note, Chad, which has previously been named for its use of child soldiers, was delisted by the UN this year. The government signed on to an action plan with the UN in 2011 to end the practice. Chad is an important troop contributor to UN peacekeeping operations, and its record as a recruiter of child soldiers threatened to jeopardize its participation in UN missions. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Today's Wednesday, July 2nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. The chief executive officer of Kenya's Coast Tourism Association says recent uptake in violence blamed on the Somali-based Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab is having a negative economic impact on the country's coastal region, which largely depends on tourism. Millicent Odhiambo tells reporter Peter Clotty that her organization has petitioned the Kenyan government to work with various Western embassies in the country to reassure tourists that it is safe to travel to Kenya's coast.
The ongoing issues that are happening in the coast have resulted to layoffs and because of lack of guests coming into the region. Our bed occupancy now, though it is the low season still, but even during the low seasons, we still are able to have conferences and other activities, which keeps us about 40% to 50% occupancy. Currently, as we speak, we are ranging between 20% and 30% occupancy because people are just not visiting the region, and it's not just international, but even the local tourists are not coming.
What plans do you have to resolve this, especially when the government keeps on saying that they have implemented security measures to improve security as well as restore confidence in the tourism sector?
There's what wholly the government's responsibility to give, and that is security. And there's what we can do as a sector by ensuring that our premises and our institutions are secure, which we have done on our part. We have installed CCTVs. We have ensured that people who come in and out of our establishment are scanned and there is utmost security. Actually, the cost for security within our establishment has doubled because we've had to add more askaris for that sake. But there's what the government now needs to do, which is the security of the nation as a nation, which we can only continue lobbying government to ensure that our intelligence is up to date and is able to detect some of these things before they really happen.
There were concerns that were expressed by some hoteliers along the coast that said that the recent U.S. travel warning has also had a negative impact on the tourism sector and the hotel industry along the coast. What can you tell me about this?
Yeah, that is true. It has had a negative impact on the tourism sector, not just the tourism sector, but also the counties as a whole, because the economy of the coast counties are sustained by tourism, meaning therefore that when tourism is low, even the running of the counties is challenged. Within the tourism sector, we have direct effects. We feel the effects directly, because then it is what is our day-to-day business. And this has led to a lot of layoffs by the hotels. We actually have some hotels which have even closed down. The travel advisories of the major tour operators not bringing in guests until October has even served to give us a very unfortunate future. We are not quite sure whether we will pick up again.
Millicent Odhiambo is Chief Executive Officer of Kenya's Coast Tourism Association. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Mombasa. An official Swaziland band, People's United Democratic Movement, also known as PUDEMO, opposition says he hopes the cancellation of the country's AGOA eligibility will speed up multi-party democracy in the country. AGOA is a U.S. trade preference that provides duty-free treatment to U.S. imports of about 6,000 products from eligible African countries. To be AGOA eligible, a country must have or be working toward a market-based economy, rule of law, elimination of trade barriers, and protection of workers' rights. But some say AGOA was never meant to be favorable to Swaziland as a monarchy with a non-party system of governance. Umpalana Shongwe, a member of PUDEMO, tells me that while the AGOA eligibility annulment might benefit labor unions in Swaziland, it might also help the pro-democracy movement in its fight for multi-party democracy.
This did not surprise us as the opposition. In fact, we were expecting the Americans to take such a step because they have been telling our government to put things in order for a long time, and they kept on promising, but nothing came out. But as an opposition, we are also alive to the fact that should we lose the AGOA, the poverty level in the country will, of course, increase by the closure of textile industries because it employs a lot of people.
What does Swaziland do? Is it because of its labor policy that it does not have a good record about protecting its workers?
The Americans put probably 5 benchmarks that the government should reach. And amongst those benchmarks, there are, of course, political ones, which for democrats, for instance, the removing of the Terrorism Act. So those are some of the things that the government kept on holding on, yet it was not benefiting them.
Swaziland is not the only country. Those countries that were also deemed to be ineligible were given until this past May, to correct their AGOA eligibility policies. Why didn't Swaziland act?
Our leaders, authorities, they seem not to have understood what AGOA means. And that is why they were not serious about reaching the benchmarks. They did not believe the Americans would do this because for a long time they have been getting away with murder. You see, but this time the Americans acted differently.
So you mentioned that one of the AGOA eligibility requirements was this, particularly for Swaziland, was this Terrorism Act?
Yes, I'm one of them. As I am standing here, I'm out on bail over this issue of terrorists and all those things. As we speak, the president of PUDEMO and the secretary of the Youth League are languishing in jail because of such laws. So to us, really, while this might benefit the labor unions, it will also benefit the pro-democracy movement.
Umpalana Shangwe is the founding member of Swaziland's banned opposition PUDEMO party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Mbabane. A risky bone marrow transplant is often successful in treating children with sickle cell disease, a genetic disorder primarily seen in people of African descent. Experts say by the time patients reach adulthood, they are usually too sick to withstand the rigorous procedure. But researchers report they were able to reverse sickle cell disease in adults using a less intensive bone marrow transplant. VOA's Jessica Burman reports.
Sickle-shaped red blood cells get trapped in blood vessels. They can clog joints, causing severe bone pain, along with difficulty breathing and pneumonia if the misshapen cells get caught in the lungs. The cells can also block blood flow in the brain, leading to stroke. Juliana Ejedobe describes the pain experienced by many sickle cell patients.
Imagine someone taking like a stick and just like stabbing, like, you know, like hitting you on your joints. That's how painful it is.
A standard bone marrow transplant involves using chemotherapy or radiation to destroy all of the spongy tissue that produces red blood cells inside the patient's bone and replacing it with compatible, healthy donor stem cells. The dramatic procedure has successfully treated children with sickle cell disease. But experts say after years of organ damage, many adult sickle cell patients are not good candidates for the full transplant. But researchers have performed a partial bone marrow transplant on 30 adult patients with severe disease, including Ejedobe. All of them had to have a sibling with matching immune characteristics as a marrow donor. The procedure, which destroyed only 30% to 50% of their marrow, effectively cured 26 of the patients, says John Tisdale, an investigator with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases in Bethesda, Maryland.
Using this less toxic way of preparing a patient for a bone marrow transplant had success rates that are comparable to the more toxic kind of transplant that's performed in children.
After 1 year, doctors were able to take half of the adult patients off medication that suppressed their immune systems as their bodies began producing healthy red blood cells. Juliana Ejidobe, who received bone marrow from her older sister, says she feels a lot better now.
Yeah, I do get pain, but it's not compared to what I used to have before.
The partial bone marrow transplant for adult sickle cell patients was described in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Argentina edged Switzerland 1-0 in extra time through a goal scored by their captain Lionel Messi in Sao Paulo on Tuesday. Elsewhere, Belgium fit the United States of America 2-1 in extra time in the last round of 16 matches played in Salvador. Meanwhile, the Cameroon Football Federation is investigating allegations of match-fixing by the Indomitable Lions following their 4-0 loss to Croatia on the 18th of June. My colleague James Batty asked Nkemeyang Paul Fuanyi, publisher of the Star Media House in Limbe, Cameroon, to shed some light on the situation.
So far, the story of match-fixing is just a rumor peddling in Cameroon now. But we know that the poor showing of the Lions in Brazil 2014 has provoked an investigation by the President of the Republic, who has set up a committee headed by the Prime Minister, head of government, Philemon Yang, to investigate what happened that Cameroon performed very poorly and then give him back the report in a month. So far, there have been allegations of match fixing by some seven players. To me, this is still rumor. Nobody has come out with the facts. As investigation is ongoing, the police have started calling players for investigation, as well as FECAFOOT officials and some top members of the Ministry of Youth and Sport. The problem started a day before the Lions departed to Brazil because the head of state asked the prime minister to hand the flag, the national flag, to the captain of the Indomitable Lions, Etofis. After a test match, Etofis led all the players away. They refused to collect the flag from the prime minister. And the flag was handed to the coach, Volker Finke, who is a German. So handing a national flag to a coach and not to a Cameroonian was the beginning of our Waterloo. Then second, the players refused to board the plane because of bonuses. They were supposed to have left Cameroon at 9 a.m. in the morning. The final left at 4 and got to Brazil late. And when they got to Brazil, we gathered that FIFA slammed them with a 120 million francs fine for coming late.
That was Nkemeyang Paul Fuanyi, publisher of the Star Media House, speaking in Limbe, Cameroon. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The number of deaths from West Africa's Ebola outbreak continues to rise as officials in the region scramble to contain the situation. The World Health Organization says 467 people have now died from Ebola. The WHO has confirmed or suspects 759 cases in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. That's it for this Wednesday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Jackson Vunganyi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa. But please stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.